Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the special Econ 101 edition of Slate Money, the first edition of 2015, and possibly the best edition of 2015, because this is going to be awesome pants, as the millennials might say.
No, wait, no millennials ever said awesome pants, Felix.
No. We have a letter, actually, here this week from Nathan Connolly, who wrote in to slatemoney@slate.com. Never let it be said that we ignore our letters. We're devoting the entire episode to Nathan's letter. And Nathan says at the very top of his letter, "Being a millennial, I appreciate having Jordan's opinion. It's about time our generation's voice makes its way into the discourse." Jordan, how do you feel about representing all millennials on this podcast?
It's a validation of everything I have spent my many months on this show doing.
So what we are going to do in this podcast is not, as we normally do, guide you through the business and finance news of the week, because frankly, Not much happens in that week between Christmas and New Year's. So we are going to answer Nathan's question instead, partly because it's a really good question. But first, well, I guess we've already introduced our resident millennial, Jordan Weissman. I should also introduce Kathy O'Neill, the data scientist and blogger at mathbabe.org.
Hi, Felix.
Hi, Kathy. Are you excited about this one, too?
I'm super excited.
Okay. So here is the question from Nathan Connolly, who is finishing up an MA in teaching, and he says, if you were to teach high school economics, comprised mostly of 16 to 18-year-olds today, what would be the top three pieces of knowledge or insight or concepts that each student should graduate taking with them for years after? He says that he would like to give his students more knowledge and insight than just those required by standardized tests. So we decided that we were going to answer, each of us was going to come up with three pieces of economic concepts, I guess you would say. And because 3 times 3 equals 10, that means we now have the top 10 economic concepts for high school students.
I'm confused, Felix. As a mathematician, could you explain that?
I can, actually, Kathy. In economics, 3 times 3 equals 10. In mathematics, 3 times 3 is 9. But in economics, and this is actually kind of an important concept, I think, 9 equals 10. That two numbers which are close enough as 9 and 10 are basically the same number.
Wow.
So here you go.
That might not be on a standardized test, kids. Yeah.
But it's an important concept to learn, that the exactitude of mathematics is nowhere in economics. And if you get 9 or if you get 10, you've basically got the same number and you shouldn't stress it.
Again, not going to help you on the AP Econ test. It's like, really? But just keep it in the back of your head.
Yeah, to any students who are listening here, this is not economics to help you pass exams. This is economics to help you in life and to make you a more numerate and sophisticated person. Is that something millennials want to be?
Yeah, I think so. Just like every generation, we aspire to at least sophistication. I don't know about numeracy.
So, Kathy, why don't you start us off?
Okay. So I'm going to start us off with the concept of supply and demand, which is actually a lot trickier than it sounds. Felix.
Yes.
You are a buyer of a product that I make.
Okay. I want a new iPhone. So you are Apple. You make iPhones.
I do make iPhones.
I'm a buyer of iPhones. I want a new iPhone. I'm willing to pay $600.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because it cost me $400 to make. So I'm not going to price it any lower than that, but I'm happy to price it at $600. But you know what?
What?
Since you're willing to pay $600 and a lot of other people are willing to pay at $600, I'm just going to actually raise my price to $700.
So I'm not willing to pay that. I want a new iPhone, but I don't want it that much.
So in other words, there's a price at which you're not going to go above.
I'm not going above $600. You're raising your price to $700, which means that I am being priced out.
Yes.
So why does that make sense for you?
Well, it could make sense for me. What if you're the only one who stops buying it?
and everyone else makes a $300 profit for you.
Yes.
And so you wind up making more money overall, even though I don't buy that phone.
So it's a calculation for me. I've lost you as a buyer, but maybe I haven't lost that many people. And for each unit I sell, I make way more profit. So I'm going to just figure out how much I can raise my price before I stop making money.
Or start making less money.
Yeah. I want to reach my maximum.
You want to maximize your profits. And
yes.
So what supply and demand is, it's a way of increasing the price of goods and services to the point at which if you raise them any more, then you'll actually start making less money rather than more.
Yes. Now, here's another way of thinking about it. You could think about a factory, or you could think of it even a natural resource where the output is fixed, though you can't change the output. And then the question
is... Say it's an oil well.
Yeah, it's an oil well. So what happens when the demand goes up for that oil, once people just buy bigger cars? Well, the price is going to go up, right?
Because the oil well is only producing a certain amount of oil.
Yes.
And more people want more oil to drive bigger cars.
Right.
And so they're then competing with each other.
We're competing, yes.
Over this finite resource of oil. And then the winners of that competition are the people who are willing to pay the most.
Exactly.
So in that sense, the price goes up as demand goes up.
That's right. The novelty Christmas present that everybody wants, which is probably this year from, what was that movie?
Frozen.
Frozen. There's a fixed supply because manufacturers can only make so many Christmas presents that are already in the stores by December 20th. Then with the really hot presents, they get really expensive, at least on the resale market.
And the ones where there's no demand, they wind up having their prices slashed on Black Monday or Black Friday or whenever it is.
Right, exactly. One last example. The way economists actually do this is kind of interesting. They flip it over. They think, well, if the output is fixed and the price has gone up, then demand must have gone up.
So basically what you do is you look at all of those Elsa dresses turning up on eBay,
yeah,
and people asking $1,000 for them, and you say, well, I deduce that there's a lot of demand for Elsa dresses just from the fact that people are paying $1,000 for them on eBay.
Exactly.
That's kind of intuitive.
Yeah. If you take an introduction to economics class, it's almost everyone is going to start that way. It's going to start with the supply and demand curve. And it really is the fundamental explanation for most of what's happening in the economy around us every single day. And people tend to lose sight of that. And coming back to the oil well example, every summer get a kind of a spate of articles saying, why are gas prices going up? And it's almost always the same basic reason, which is people drive more in the summer. There's
yeah,
more demand.
Perfect example.
And that's really what it comes down to. And just people kind of forget that. And so that needs to be kind of re-explained. But if you're thinking about an economic problem, the first place you should always visit is supply and demand.
Yep.
On which note, we should move to my topic, which is sunk costs. And this is one of my favorite concepts in economics because it is kind of the opposite of supply and demand. Supply and demand is something almost all of us understand intuitively, and sunk costs is something which almost all of us get wrong. And the idea behind sunk costs is that once you've spent money, it's spent. You don't need to worry about how much you've spent anymore because that's in the past, and crying over spilt milk is pointless. And so here's one example. Let's say that you go online and buy two tickets to the movies tonight. And then someone else invites you to an awesome dinner.
Mm.
So the question is, do you say, oh, I can't go to dinner because I already bought my tickets to the movies and it would be a waste of that money to go to dinner? Or do you say, I actually value going to dinner more than I value going to the movie, so I'm going to go to dinner because I've already spent that money.
Right. Let me give you another example, which makes me sad, but I always think about it when people talk about the lottery. There was once a letter writer to an advice column that said, I've been buying lottery tickets every week for 20 years, and so far I haven't won anything, but I don't want to like just turn away from my investments. Should I keep buying lottery tickets? And you know, what they didn't understand is that once you bought a lottery ticket and you haven't won the lottery, that is a sunk cost. You might
as well
just walk away.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the concept of sunk cost too, because it applies outside of economics as well. Like when you're talking to friends about like their dating lives or whatnot, and they're like, oh, well, I've been in this relationship for a while. You know, I might as well keep pushing it. It's like, no, no, that's sunk cost. You can move on to somebody else. It's also, it's a really powerful fallacy. That's the other thing. People really fall into it, and it dictates the way corporations work. In a lot of ways, people, you know, a project kind of gets a momentum of its own in an office, and people don't want to give up on all the resources that have already been spent. So it's something you kind of have to be aware of, I think, in just everyday life.
And in my professional life, I can tell you that one of the reasons I left Reuters was because the CEO of Reuters Media decided that after sinking $15 million or thereabouts into this big project that I was working on called Reuters Next, that it still didn't actually make sense to continue to invest in this thing. So he killed it.
Which is good on his end,
which
in a way.
He understood the sunk cost fallacy, and he understood that just because we'd already put all of this money into the project didn't mean that that wasn't in and of itself a reason to continue to put more money into the project.
No, absolutely.
So, you know, it did mean that I lost a fun job, but it was at least a sign that the CEO knew what he was doing. Jordan, inflation.
Yes. So my first subject is inflation. What is inflation? It's just the rate at which prices on average are rising in an economy. That's it. People have a really tough time with this concept. You know how you can see people having a tough time? Every time someone reports a box office record saying this is the highest grossing movie in X number of years and it's not inflation adjusted. And so it's just sort of something ambiently you need to be aware of, but it also just dictates a huge amount of what happens in our economy. You can't know about what's going on at the central bank, for instance, what its purpose is, unless you know that it's essentially there to, in a lot of ways, make sure prices stay stable, that we don't have too much inflation.
So wait, let's come back to this whole idea of just what inflation is, because in real life, you know, prices move around all over the place. If my rent goes up by 10%, does that mean we have 10% inflation?
No, and this is something that people, sophisticated people, miss a lot of time. Inflation is an average. You know, the BLS, it has a consumer price.
What's the BLS?
Oh, sorry, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which tracks inflation. It's part of the government, has the consumer price index. And they go and they collect information on everything from housing to the cost of cars, the cost of cookies. I kid you not, there are cookies and cakes. That's one of the items. And they track it around the country. And they create an average of what prices are doing in the economy. And just because prices on one thing are going up doesn't mean that prices are going up on something else. And so you get this kind of central number.
And then they also have to do this thing. I mean, it's really, measuring inflation is really complicated. If your cars are getting faster and more fuel efficient and safer, or if your phone is getting bigger and more powerful and lighter, then, you know, even if the price goes up, that doesn't necessarily mean it's inflation because you're getting more for your money. So you have to adjust for that as
well.
Yes,
you have to get higher quality goods, essentially. You get play a role in this. And this is something that people often miss as well, is that it varies regionally. So there might be inflation in San Francisco, but there might be deflation in Atlanta, you know, possibly. Generally speaking, you know, we're one monetary system. That's probably not going to happen. But
it does happen in one monetary system. I mean, we have a great example right now in the European Union.
That's true.
Inflation in Germany and deflation in Spain. And they both have euros. And the European Central Bank doesn't know really how to react to this because the Germans are worried about inflation. That's part of what Germans do, is they worry about inflation. And the Spanish have deflation. And deflation is actually, and we'll just finish on this one, a worse thing than inflation. People think of inflation as a bad thing because it means your dollar is worth less. You can buy less with your dollar. But actually, for reasons which we don't have time to go into, but you can easily look up, the problems of deflation are much worse than the problems of anything but the very highest inflation.
I would love to spend an entire episode just talking about, like, the virtues of inflation.
Well, I also just want to throw in, and I'm just echoing what you just said, Felix, that this is a great example of, like, a U-shaped thing where if you go too low, it's bad. Deflation is bad. If you go way, way high to hyperinflation, that's really bad.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a magic spot in the middle.
And the magic spot in the middle has normally been understood to be around 2%.
Yep.
The central banks and the people who run the economy don't try to target 0% inflation. They try to target 2% inflation. Mm-hmm. And now there's a big debate in the economics profession about whether it should be higher than that, maybe more like 3 or 4%.
There was an awesome article recently in the New York Times about where the 2% number came from, actually. And it has to do with basically New Zealand. Like a bunch
thanks,
of
thanks, New Zealand.
Yeah.
You came up with this number out of thin air, and now all of us are treating it as holy writ.
It's fantastic. Anyway,
so Moving on, Jordan, we're going to talk about The Invisible Hand, which, if I'm counting, is topic number 5. We're halfway through.
We're number 5 or are we number 4?
You're 5-4. In economics, it's all pretty much the same thing.
1 + 1 = 4.
Okay, I'm not going to let you say 0 is 1, though. Okay.
By the time we're done with this, we're going to be up to 5.
Yeah.
For reasons that we will discover.
Yes, actually we will. So, The Invisible Hand, it's one of the most popular phrases in economics. Just kind of everyone's heard it at some point. What is it? Basically, it's the idea that individuals pursuing their own self-interest, selfishly, will unintentionally provide for the greater good. The idea that if you see an
So I'm being selfish and you benefit from me being selfish.
Exactly.
I should just be more selfish.
Yeah, we should just all be more selfish. We should just take each other's food.
We're going to get to that.
Is that what that means?
In a minute. But So this is from Adam Smith, the father of modern economics. He only used it 3 times in all of his writing. It was never actually central to it, really. It's most famously used in The Wealth of Nations. But he never used the word capitalism. That was Karl Marx who gave us that phrase. But he did use the invisible hand. And it really is kind of our foundation of the idea that you don't need to centrally plan an economy, that if somebody sees an opportunity to make a profit making something, they will devote their energy to do that. They'll make something. Someone will buy it. It'll provide that person a salary. They will use their energy most efficiently to make a living for themselves. And over time, you're going to get the greatest possible
good. My favorite example of the invisible hand is the old joke about the woman with the corner store. And you go into the corner store and say, do you have any apples? And she said, oh, no, we used to get them in, but they just sell out all the time.
Well, another sort of modern example is sort of like what Silicon Valley wants to be doing when they say they're causing disruption. They say they're seeing something inefficient and they're going to be like throwing some new kind of tricky technology or middleman service in the middle to make things more efficient.
The point is what you want. Everyone is looking for something that people want. People are looking for pain points that they can soothe.
Right.
If a corner store discovers that people really want to buy apples, it will get in more apples because that's what people want. And a billion of those decisions being made around the world every day creates an economy.
Exactly. Now, there's a flip side to the invisible hand, however, because a lot of people like to just kind of invoke it as this rule that if we just let the invisible hand, the market take care of it, everything will be fine. And that is something known as the tragedy of the commons, which actually it's a much later concept. It was first coined, I learned, in 1968. I didn't realize this. But it's the idea that a bunch of people acting in their own self-interest, utilizing a limited public resource, will accidentally deplete that resource and kind of screw themselves over.
And I think the reason it's called the commons is because we had like a common plot of land where everybody would bring their sheep to graze.
That's the example that the essay that this came from used, was that imagine a bunch of sheep herders essentially bringing their animals to a public meadow, right? And each sheep herder has it in his self-interest to bring an extra sheep, just saying, oh, well, it's profitable for me to bring one more animal on so I can later sell it. Except then if each herder does it, eventually they're just going to graze away all the grass.
Ooh, I got a great example. The subway doors are about to close, and each person sticks their foot in trying to be the last person on the subway. It makes sense for that individual to get on that subway, but it's making everyone on the subway wait for them.
Exactly. The tragedy of the commons right now that you can experience at your local sushi restaurant is overfishing. Is essentially you have all these commercial operations going in and trying to get their bluefin tuna or whatever, going for wild salmon, and they are overfishing. It for each individual, fisherman boat makes sense to get as big a catch as you can. However, it's depleting the resources.
So the invisible hand is why things work, and then the tragedy of the commons is
why they
don't
work.
The exception to the rule.
Yeah.
Interesting. Kathy, let's have you talk about causality.
Yeah.
What is causality?
So causality is basically why, explaining why something happens. Economists care about why. They care about causality. They want to know why something's true, not just what's going to happen. And it's in stark contrast from finance people. Like, I used to work in finance. We used to try to predict the markets. We didn't care about why the market would go up or down. We just thought we saw a pattern, and we sometimes did see patterns, and we'd want to predict it and make money off of it. It's a very different concept than understanding what exactly happened that made the market go up or down.
But a pure black box is not a very good predictor, is it? If you're looking for a pattern, one of the reasons why you put money behind that pattern and say, well, it's worked in the past, so it's likely to work in the future, is because you think that you have a reason why it works.
I mean, vaguely speaking, but at a given moment, your black box just spits out a number. You're not trying to analyze that specific prediction.
Yeah, I think also, again, this is just one of those kind of ambient issues you have to be aware of, just correlation versus causation, right? Oh, it's constantly coming up and we're constantly...
Wait, repeat that?
Correlation does not equal causation.
So this is a slightly different thing, but it's important to understand. Causality is just basically where one thing causes something else. Yeah. And correlations are things which economists love. You'll also hear the word regression.
Yes.
If you take two things and one goes up at the same time as the other goes up and one goes down at the same time as the other goes down, then you say they're correlated. And you find out whether the two things are correlated by running something known as a regression. And then the minute that you find out the two things are correlated, you get some snarky guy on Twitter saying, correlation does not equal causation. In other words, you can't assume that one of them causes the other. But it is, again, very sort of natural to assume that either one has caused the other or that they have some kind of common cause.
Another thing to be aware is there are lots of statistical tools that economists have tried to come up with to prove causality off of data where it's kind of hard to figure it out. And it's always worth kind of questioning, even if an economist says, oh, I have shown or really come close to showing causality, you always have to have a little bit of skepticism.
Yeah, nothing, again, this is the 9 equals 10 thing. Nothing in economics is certain. Yep. It's not a science where you have an absolute proof. A proof in economics is not the same as a proof in mathematics.
Yes.
But enough on causality. We are moving swiftly, and I'm going to start talking about opportunity costs, because this is one of my favorite concepts. It comes up time and time again in daily life, and again, it's one which isn't deeply understood. When you think about the cost of something, you basically normally think about how much is this going to cost me in terms of dollars or sometimes in terms of time. But there's another cost, which is what's the alternative? So to take the example of my, media CEO at Reuters, if he was spending $15 million on a web strategy, then that would be the cost of the web strategy. He'd say, hey, it's $15 million. Is it worth it? But in order to answer that question, you also have to understand the opportunity cost, which is if I took that $15 million and spent it on something else instead, what would the return on that be? And if the return on the alternative would be higher than the return on the web strategy, you're better off taking the money and spending it on the alternative.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that another really common example where opportunity cost becomes really important is, do I go to school? Do I go to grad school? Where do I go to? Do I spend money on a private college or a public college? Things along those lines. When people are trying to figure out the value of a college degree, for instance, the way they do it is they look at part of what they look at is opportunity costs. What would you have made working those years if you weren't going to school?
Let me put my little plug in for my lifetime earnings generator on fusion.net/lifetime_earnings. And it shows. We have a bunch of data from a company called PayScale. And it really shows that the cost of going to college, people think of the cost of going to college as the tuition fees or maybe the amount they'll go into debt. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the biggest cost of going to college is not the tuition fee of the college. It's the amount of money that you would have made if you hadn't gone to college. Mm-hmm. If you would have made $100,000, $200,000 over those 4 years, then that's much bigger than the amount you wind up spending in tuition.
And I just want to throw in that it doesn't have to be monetarily based. Like those, your widget, what's it called?
The lifetime earnings?
The lifetime earnings.
It's called... Should you take the plunge?
It only talks about money, but of course there's opportunity costs that are non-monetary as well. Like when you decide whether you should have children or not, it costs a lot of money. Nobody would have children if they only considered money because it just costs a lot of money. And it's not like we're living in a culture where your kids are expected to take care of you when you get old. So you're really thinking, okay, this is what my life would be. If I do have kids, this is what my life would be. If I don't have kids, and you're comparing them in some more holistic way.
Are you saying that my childless existence is full of costs which I don't even really appreciate? And if I appreciated them, maybe I would have had kids?
They're opportunity costs. But maybe, everybody's calculus is different. But opportunity cost is something that we do every time we make a decision.
And so, again, with this 9 equals 10 kind of world of economics, I'm going to segue from opportunity costs into my other big idea that I think high school students should understand. And this one, I think, is probably the hardest. If you don't understand this one, it's okay. And if you don't understand opportunity costs, you're not even going to understand this one. So just bear with me if you're getting a bit befuddled at this point. But the concept I'm going to talk about is comparative advantage. And this is the single most unintuitive thing that virtually everyone tries to get taught in economics. And again, this is probably on that AP exam or whatever it is that you're going to take. And you're going to say, oh no, it's, you know, I don't understand it. And if you don't understand it, that's entirely natural. And if you do understand it, that means you're a little bit weird and you might even wind up becoming an economist. Comparative advantage is basically this. It's about trade and it's also about opportunity costs. It's about saying that if you have a group of people, and economists like to simplify things, so they normally bring it down to two. If you have two people, and let's say me and Kathy is better than me at everything. Anything I can do, she can do better, basically.
I didn't say it.
Then it still makes sense for Kathy to trade with me, to buy things from me. Let's say that we both, and there's a great example which we'll link to on the page for this show, using bananas and fish. And let's say that I can produce 10 bananas a day and I can fish 10 fish a day. And Kathy can produce 10 bananas a day and she can fish 30 fish a day. Then it makes sense for Kathy to buy bananas off me with fish rather than producing bananas herself. Or even if she could produce 20 bananas a day, but she can still produce 30 fish a day, it behooves her to not produce bananas, to outsource the production of bananas to me, who can only produce 10 bananas a day, and to use all of her efforts catching fish.
Because the opportunity cost to her of spending time raising bananas is time that she could have been using getting those fish.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is a big idea in free trade, is that the idea is that countries are going to benefit from it, because even if the United States can do everything better than Bolivia or whoever, there's still going to be things we want to outsource to them because we don't want to spend our time raising some sort of crop or something along
those lines. Quinoa.
Quinoa, exactly.
Yes. And so the even if we're better at producing quinoa than the Bolivians, it makes sense for Bolivia to produce quinoa and export it to us, and for us to use our productive capacities where they're best used, making iPhones. Say.
Yes. Although, I don't know, would we actually be better at producing quinoa? I think they might be. I don't know if we even have that.
We're pretty good farmers, actually.
They are. In fact, this is actually a very good example of comparative advantage. Quinoa is a huge crop in Bolivia and almost nowhere else because quinoa is where Bolivia has a comparative advantage. You can grow just about anything in Bolivia if you put your mind to it, but Bolivia isn't particularly good at producing just about anything. It is particularly good, or it's least bad, at producing quinoa. And so that's what it winds up concentrating on.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a great example, and it points to a larger thing, which comes straight out of comparative advantage, which is that when you do have free trade, you end up having countries that specialize in their niche products because of comparative advantage. So you have certain countries that just do one bananas and other countries that do lots and lots of quinoa, which you wouldn't have otherwise. And that's good and bad, right? It's not always good.
So if we're tallying up great economists here, and we've had Adam Smith, the great economist who we need to credit is David Ricardo. Mm-hmm. He is the guy who came up with this idea of comparative advantage and changed the course of economics. So thank you, David Ricardo.
Yeah, not even his only great contribution. He's had many.
Jordan, we're going to start winding down here with a bit more sort of real world stuff. You're going to talk about...
You'll be shocked. I want to talk about income inequality.
Is this economics?
It is economics. I think, you know, I'm not going to rehearse every discussion about income inequality we've had on this show and elsewhere, but I'm going to say why I think it needs to be taught, which is that it is a fundamentally economic issue. It's about how resources are distributed and how those change our incentives and the way we act as a society and how incentives change the way those resources are distributed.
And the man who's done more to bring this issue front and center in recent years is Thomas Piketty, mm-hmm. who is an economist and a very good economist. This is deep in the heart of economics, even though some economists don't like talking about it.
And I mean, Marx was an economist. He was deeply concerned with distribution. It was sort of one of the original issues that was talked about in economics, and it's kind of come back into vogue in contemporary times. But I think it just it's not the type of thing that would typically be taught in a high school class.
So what's to be taught here? Just that different people make more money than other people?
No,
why is that interesting? What's the debate? What's the question?
I think the debate, as I understand it, is whether our capitalist system or whatever the system is that we have is actually causing income inequality.
So there's the really big macro picture was, does capitalism naturally, and this is Piketty's argument, is that unfettered capitalism naturally leads to inequality. That it's
not just to inequality, but to increasing inequality
over time, a gradual concentration.
There's no society on Earth with no inequality. Some people will always make more than others. But what we have in the United States right now is a very high degree of inequality. There's a wonderful way of measuring this called the Gini coefficient. And what's more, we have increasing inequality in almost every country in the world. This Gini coefficient is going up around the world.
That's right.
And I think that that's a great way to frame it. This question is, does capitalism naturally lead to increasing inequality? And just for the sake of so people can understand what they're reading about, you need to get into the different ways we measure. Things like Gini, things like the share of income going to the 1%, which is a very different measure than Gini and tells us different things.
Because this is a debate and it's interesting and these things aren't clear cut, it's worth emphasizing that while if you measure the Gini coefficient of any country you care to look at, it's almost certainly going up, global income inequality is actually going down.
This is actually not what we can – this is another full episode's worth of debate. However, it's actually that was sort of a consensus for a bit. It's not clear anymore.
In any case, we can talk about beyond like how to measure inequality and exactly what's happening with it is what actual – policies can be put into place to change that momentum if it is
and whether it is in and of itself a bad thing. If you want the greatest good for the greatest number of people, is it good to have lower inequality? And is happiness correlated to absolute income or to relative income? These are all interesting questions that can be talked about.
It brings to very basic questions of fairness.
Well, as I say, it's where economics intersects with values. And that's something economists kind of like to keep out of economics in a lot of ways, is to kind of keep it value-free.
What a perfect segue to my final topic.
What is your final topic?
My final topic is basically that models are not reality. We've gone through a phase of economics that has become very, very highly mathematical based. Like you have very fancy mathematics, you have calculus and differential equations and all sorts of things flying around. We've said this a couple of times already, it's not necessarily completely believable that everything actually is a mathematical thing. So going back to Piketty, actually, he was going to be my example. So it was a perfect segue. Piketty got his PhD at MIT and had a very fancy thesis with lots of mathematical equations. But after a while, he was like, this is kind of silly how much people over here in the States love mathematics around economics. And he went back to France, and now he's an economist in France. And in France, economics is part of social studies. It's part of the social. It's not even considered mathematics. And I think that's an appropriate place for it. So I'm just making the point that models...
The mathematician wants to kick the economist out of her field.
Well, I do think that you have a kind of authority that you may not deserve when you use mathematical equations. Sometimes, by the way, I don't want to say that they're useless. I mean, everyone uses models, and so does Piketty. Piketty has a model, and he manages to speak both to American economists and economists in France because his model is very simple, and models are useful. They're locally true, possibly, but usually in extreme events, like when you have a time of financial crisis or something, a lot of models fail. So you should always take them with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think that it ties into two questions, which is one, explain to people what economists actually do, which is largely they make models. They make simplified versions of reality, and that's the definition.
They're economists who do nothing except for play around with things called DSGE models. And trust me, you do not need to know what a dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model is, except to know that it doesn't reflect the actual world, but economists still love to use it because they think that by playing with their DSGE model, they might be able to have an insight into something somewhere.
Yes.
And sometimes they do. Sometimes it's luck more than anything else, too. I mean, I know economists who actually don't believe in any models whatsoever. they're ideas rather than truths.
They're thought experiments.
Thought experiments, thank
and,
you.
And Einstein was a great believer in thought experiments. Thought experiments can be very useful. And at least in economics, what you can do is you can often find the data set where you can test your model and its predictions against reality. So that helps too.
Yeah. Part of the problem with economics, of course, is that they're trying to address really big issues like, will this country come out of recession and such and such? And there's often not enough data to actually do that in a very deliberate way.
But let's also finish off here by emphasizing that although most of the economics that is discussed and debated on shows like this and in newspapers and on television is exactly what you're talking about, which is known as macroeconomics, that's not all of economics, or it's not even necessarily most of economics. The people who are concerned with public policy questions and central banking and bank regulation and all of that are a significant minority of economists. And there's a whole field out there called microeconomics, which is much more scientific and much more practical, which doesn't talk about the economy as a whole and just talks about things like, should I tear up my movie tickets for tonight? And that's kind of more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I said you kind of have to talk about what do economists do, and it's actually getting harder and harder to define that. I mean, you get behavioral economics, which really kind of meshes their economic modeling and mathematical techniques with psychology. And so it's becoming much broader than just the modeling that used to dominate the field.
Yeah, Daniel Kahneman, the great economist who won the Nobel Prize in economics, is a psychologist, really. He's not an economist. Or he is an economist. Or all of us are economists in some sense.
That's really... You don't have to pass your AP econ test to be an economist.
Wait. Well, you should study anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm the only person sitting around this table who never took a single semester's worth of economic anything. And I do like to say that I'm not an economist. In the profession, there's a technical definition of being an economist. It means you have a PhD in economics, which also means that Paul Volcker, for instance, the legendary chairman of the Federal Reserve, is not an economist, if you ask economists, because he never got his PhD. But for the rest of us, being an economist is just thinking in a sort of numerically sophisticated way about what's going on in the world. And so with that, we are going to bring this pedagogical edition of Slate Money to a close. I thank you all for listening to it and for making it through to the very end, and maybe you learned something, and quite probably you were screaming at the three of us saying, that's wrong, you've got it all wrong, in which case we want to hear your responses. So the email, as ever, is slatemoney@slate.com. Do continue to subscribe to our show, which you can find by searching for Slate Money in the iTunes store. And thank you very much to everyone who writes to us, but especially to Nathan Connolly, who sparked off this whole discussion. So that's it for us for this week. Our producer was Dan Alcorn. The managing producer is Joel Meyer. And the executive producer of all of Slate's podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Kathy O'Neill and Jordan Weissman, I'm Felix Salmon, and we'll go back to slightly more regular programming next week on Slate Money.